as a youth, up to about 16 or so. My dad was a surveyor to the War Department in Ireland. And he took the family out there. I think there was one, two, three, four boys and my mother and father, you see. And we lived in quite a good house there. It had a big wall around it, a vegetable garden, a coach house. Of course, we were about 10 years or 12 years old, all of us. And there used to be a French family in the big house next, well, a field or two away. And it used to be a regular thing for the British with short sticks to go up and try and get into the French camp. And they had big poles. And they had an old village. He was there, vanguard like. And this old goat used to come at us and you couldn't knock him over. I remember hitting him on the head with a stick. He took no notice. Oh, but it was all in good fun. And then I remember, see, it was a big barracks town they were building in Kildare. And there were enough boys there, oh no, 10 or 14 or so, to make a football team. So we challenged the town boys. And when they rolled up, there were about 30 of them, and they all had hooky sticks. I thought, I guess it was a game of Gaelic. Well, that's what they call it, I don't know. Well, we finally got 11 of them to play ball with us. I don't remember how it went. I played football in France against the it was a Belgian cavalry crowd. And I'd never known men who run so fast, so many of them. They were like deers. They run around us. Then the next thing I know is I met my wife to be. I was about 8 or more, we got back to London. And I guess I was about 18 then. And we both used to travel up to London. But we did get as far as the city itself, I think it was London Fields. And we used to meet at lunchtime at a park, a little garden, and sit there and chat. Then I had to start business. Lucky for me, my dad was a very good building surveyor, corner surveyor. He had an office in Finsbury Square. I can remember it now, windows on the left and on the right. A big counter desk all around. And he could look out and see the Ship Hotel on the other side. I often used to go there for a drink. Well, that lasted 2 or 3 years. And then I decided I'd better get qualified. So I took a 12-month crammer course in surveying. and I passed everything except the actual filter vein, which was a part of the Qantas vein. You had to be able to use a chain and a rod and all that. And that day I got the flu. So I couldn't handle it. But I got through it, I got a diploma as a building surveyor. And I joined the firm. Myself, my elder brother, and my dad. And we had a good clientele of architects. And the Guild of Builders was formed then in London for the South. And my dad was appointed surveyor. Naturally, I went along with him. And I remember the first job we went after was, I don't know if it was 40 or 400 now, we had both. And my dad got the contract out of, you know, all the London builders. And they probably made a complaint about it. I remember going up to the city to see the commissioner, or whatever he's called, if I can now. And my father had to poo his figures, you see. Well, his record alone was proof. He was about the smartest surveyor in London, and reckoned so. And an estimator, building estimator. And if he wanted a job, he got it. That's all there was to it. Well, the government, the housing commissioner, over there, said okay, and we went ahead. And the building guild was started by the trades and unions. And the idea was that there would be no lost time or wet time or anything like that. Continuous pay. And my dad did tell me that it was doing very good. Made enough money to, you know, establish themselves good, and they got several other contracts. Some of them were big ones. $1.5 million or something. And then there was a fly in the ointment. The same thing was happening in the north of England. And they got involved. The surveyor was not, I guess, first class. And they went into bankruptcy. So the southern London people decided to throw their assets into it. And that's cost a damn lot. They paid off, I guess, but it broke the guild up. It was something like the old guilds. There were some radical people in it. The accountant was a socialist, I know. And it was a really good thing, just for that north of London. So after that, I was getting towards 20 then.
What year would this be?
About 1910 to 1914, in between there, 3 or 4 years. suddenly the war came on, and I remember I knew a lot of stock exchange clerks, and we walked London trying to get into the army, and they couldn't take us. It was snowed under. And my two brothers got into the artillery, and my brother into the war with scouts. And I got into a special service attached to the old army, kind of a flying unit. Went to France. Oh, I remember the last days in the Aldershot. Kitchener came down to us, and it rained and rained and rained, and we were out there for about half an hour before it turned up. We weren't very thankful. After that, I was sent to Woolwich to a remount depot, and I saw some of the classiest riding I've ever seen. Talk about shows. Those boys, they were all about my size, most of them. Well, one or two very tall fellows, but most of them were about 5'6". Rough riders, they call them. And I remember the wild Mustangs from Canada coming over. And these fellows making them in. I remember, they taught me to ride a bit on the major's horse. It had to be exercised, so I guess it was all right. And they had a peculiar way of riding, practically a wild horse. They'd gather the reins, get their hand on the pommel, and then leap and hang over him. We wouldn't throw a leg over, they hang over. And after it been around, good settled down, been around, they'd throw a leg, and wasn't long before he was a tame horse. One night, I was sergeant of the guard that night. A big bay horse, tremendous thing, as big as an elephant, and a little Canadian pony got into the same stall with him, and he wouldn't come out. He was scared of it, or scared to tip, and a trembling. I remember how he trembled, that horse, and the big dray horse just stood there, you know, and as if he'd swing over and crush him. And I remember I said, "Is there one of you guys can get in there?" And a fella jumped up with the major, caught both horses, and gradually backed the pony out, jumped down and came out with him. I thought it was a bit of nerve. Oh dear. When I was at Woolwich, there's an underground passage from Woolwich to the other side. There's a river, I guess. And that's how we used to go and leave. Well, my mother and my fiancé used to come and see me about, sometimes once a week. I remember the last time they came, it poured cats and dogs. So I had to take them up in my room and get them dried out. And I had a big Corporal Young. Reminds me of this guy here. I think he was somebody rather important, because there was a little scare of some sort about spies or something like that. And this corporal had a whole carload of brass hats come down and certify for him. He evidently knew them and they knew him. So I often wonder, I thought he must have been an investigator or something. Well, he was kind of foreign too. I would say Hungarian or something. Tall fellow. Then the war came along and I got out there. I got out in January, and sometime in February, no, August, that was the war, wasn't it? And September, right? August, September. I got into a very bad condition. Lungs and pleurisy and pneumonia and everything. And I had 10 days in an oxygen tent. The nurse, the matron, wrote and told my people they didn't think I'd get home. But shortly after that I found myself on the boat on a stretcher, lashed to the gunwale on a stack pipe, and the waves tipping it up over some voice. But I went to St. Mark's Hospital, where I admitted it, funny thing. And the doctor there turned me down at first. He closed up like, and suddenly he said, "Your name Browning?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Was your grandfather in the Indian Army?" I said, "Yes." "We live for Lucknow, the fighting fists, Northumberlands." So he said, "I've got just a thing for you." So he examined me and put me through, and I was an SS man. I often laughed about that, could have meant something bad. But anyway, we went to Aldershot and did one or two long marches, reviewed by Kitchener, and then I was back off to Woolwich in the SS units. They were mostly technical or college people, and we were given the rank of sergeant. And I went out to France as a sergeant. After the last, then I was in Berlin, of course. And then I went back, and a Major Solomon, I think it was, came to see me. That was at Havre. I was getting bitten about. Found out who I was, and he said, "I'm going to send you up Ireland to take over a unit." And they said, "If you don't make good, you go back." So I thought, "Well, you're a pleasant guy." And anyway, I must have made good. We because my unit became the number one unit of the 1st Subdivisions. And we travelled from the breakthrough at Roy's Hill and Tinkhall. We were Tinkhall, it was only a matter of 2 or 3 miles. Roy's Hill. Tinkhall wasn't a town, it was just a place where Hennessy used to be. He had a bandy store, I suppose. And that's where he got the name for his horse, Tinkle. Well, I forget the month now, but the boss made an awful big slam there, and I, being to Tinkle, saw factories, a whole field go by at a gallop, wagons and trucks and guns. And then the next thing I knew, there was an officer and a couple of dozen men laid across the road. We were standing up there watching. I went over and spoke to him, and suddenly he said, "I guess you'd better take your gig out." And he said, "If another wreck can come down, get aboard." So a lone wagon, what the? Truck came down. We piled aboard, and he took us back a little way to a canal. Dumped us down there, and there was a well, big well, and it was full of goldfish, carp I guess they were. And the funny thing was they were 2 or 3 deep and head to tail, like a solid ring, and they kept going round and round this well, and you could, I tried to catch them once. I dropped in a line or something, a pin on, I think, but they took no notice. They just keep round and round. Then the next thing I knew, a bargee turned up in a beautiful barge, all mahogany inside, and his wife and child, and a coop of hens. And he anchored up just about where this well was. And he used to let his hens out in the morning, and then he'd gather them up and shut them aboard. And then he got to, he invited me aboard once or twice for coffee. And all this time my guys were further back in like the kind of a park. I never saw them. I knew they were there. But that was only a little interlude. Next thing I know, a truck came for us up the line again, and it's a funny thing, every time there was an attempt by the boss to break through, we'd be at that spot. I think there was 1, 2, 3, 4 places. The first was this Tinkle, and the last was somewhere near St. Nidisbald. Near the Portuguese held that front was the British in reserve, and the Portuguese gave way. And I remember, I suppose the British held them. Of course, two of the guys boys of 18, I remember them, came down to my place, and all they wanted was something to eat or drink. So I turned them over to the cook, and they got eaten away there and had good fill up. And I remember one of them turning around to the other and saying, "Well, so and so, I guess we better go back." And off they went.
Rough.
I also remember seeing the British relieve the French at the end of the Maginot Line. The French came out as if they were on parade, all spick and span, bayonets shining, and our fellow went in there like a lot of pack houses, khaki, all mudded up. And I remember standing and watching them. And this entrance to the line was like a big cave. And they just about stand up to go into it. And then of course they turn into the concrete line. And the next time I knew the Prince of Wales, as he was then, the Duke of Windsor, was in the centre of four guys, and he marched past my tent, never looking right, and I was so surprised, I didn't get up and say anything. Afterwards I thought, why didn't I get up and say, you know, the Prince of Wales, I can get my voice out. But they just talked off, and then the others come up, and all they wanted was a drink, a rum. And they flooded over our camp looking for it, and the officers couldn't do a darn thing about it, and they didn't take no notice. Well, they settled down after a while, and the next morning they went up and took some trenches at Freecourt, I think. Just walking distance from my place. And then from there they went on to Albert and took Albert. But the British one, I tried a couple of times to do that, and I hadn't made it. But the others just went right through. And the same morning that they went on, I went up to the Freecourt trenches, and I was amazed. They were deep trenches, about nearly 10 feet, I guess. And they were all lattice work, both sides. Interwoven lattice and dugout in the one side, and there was a piano in there, but no sign of anybody, of course. Another thing I remember, we were at rest just outside Paris. And a sergeant major came through. I was on, I'd got a day's pass if I wanted to use it.